College campuses across the U.S. on edge in the face of growing protests over the Israel-Hamas war.
University presidents should be very cautious about calling in armed police into volatile situations on their campus where emotions are high because of the risk of tragic violence.
Renewed efforts for a ceasefire agreement that could avoid an even bigger human catastrophe in Gaza.
This has been described as sort of a last-ditch effort ahead of a possible Israeli ground offensive in Rafah, where half of Gaza's 2.3 million people now live.
And world leaders gathered this week to discuss progress on the first ever legally binding international treaty to end plastic pollution. Experts say the oceans are the epicenter. Today is Saturday, April 27th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi there, I'm Lori London in Washington. The University of Southern California has canceled its upcoming main graduation ceremony as demonstrations and more encampments pop up at campuses across the United States over the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. Students are calling for universities to separate themselves from any companies that are advancing Israel's military efforts in Gaza, and in some cases, from Israel itself.
And this came about because we as students and other members of the UCLA community have been seeing the 6 months of Israel's genocide of Palestinians. We've seen the 75 plus years of Israeli occupation of Palestine. And we came together to make demands on the university.
In Washington, VOA caught up with a Jewish student who came to show her support for the pro-Palestinian movement at a demonstration at George Washington University.
I'm a Jewish student myself, but I've been really deeply saddened to see what's been going on to the innocent Palestinians for not even months now, but for decades and decades. It's just always been something that I'm really passionate about, but it's gotten to the point where we cannot sit any longer and be complicit with what the Israeli government is doing to Palestinians. We can't be complicit in our school giving money to organizations that are supporting these horrible endeavors, and it's just gotten to the point where I feel like every student needs to really use their voice and stand up.
Still, some Jewish students say the protests have veered into anti-Semitism and made them afraid to set foot on campus.
You know, there can be valid criticism of Israel. At the same time, you want to make sure what you're saying specifically is not offensive and hurtful to Jewish students.
According to a Reuters tally, nearly 550 arrests have been made in the last week across major U.S. universities in relation to the protests over Gaza. During a pro-Palestinian demonstration at Emory University, Atlanta, Georgia, on Thursday, eyewitness video showed a detainee being tased by law enforcement officers. University authorities have said the demonstrations are often unauthorized and have called on police to clear them. Joining us now for some perspective is Henry Sears, who is a co-president of J Street at Columbia University, part of a student-driven network of pro-Israel, pro-Palestine, pro-peace activists organizing on campuses.
What can you tell us about the current situation on the ground there? What's the mood?
The mood has gotten a lot calmer now than it was a couple of days ago with the protests. Progress was made between Columbia University Apartheid Divest, the organizers of the encampment, and the administration, where they agreed to make sure that non-students left the encampment and to try to tone down the rhetoric from the outside protesters and prevent discriminatory and harassing language. So, I mean, we have seen alarming things come out of the protest, but I am hopeful that them working with the admin will mean that it becomes a safer spot for Jewish students.
What do you mean by alarming?
There was a viral video where protesters, it's unclear if they were students because they were outside the gates, but protesters that were from an organization that was invited by CUAD were screaming at students, we want 10,000 more October 7th to happen, or go back to Poland, go back to Belarus, or using profanity against Jewish students.
Is your group participating in the demonstrations? Do you have any sort of active role, or are you just sort of monitoring the situation?
No, I'm the co-president of J Street, which is a pro-peace pro-Israel, pro-Palestine organization. So we support the right of Israel to exist along an independent state of Palestine in the West Bank and Gaza. So I have not been participating in this. We do not agree with the demands of the protesters. And also, even if we did, the protesters do not want people who do not support BDS to be in their camp. BDS, which is the movement Boycott, Divest, Sanctions, which is about divesting from the Israeli economy, boycotting Israeli products, and isolating Israel on the international stage. And since we don't support that message, we are not welcome there.
Do you support their concerns over the situation on the ground in Gaza?
Yes, for sure. Personally, I hope there is a bilateral ceasefire so humanitarian aid can come into Gaza and rebuild it, and the hostages should come home immediately. That is my highest priority. However, what they're protesting for on the lawn, while it is in solidarity with Gaza, it is for the university to comply with their demands, which are divesting the endowment from Israel, ending the Tel Aviv University dual BA program, and making sure that the Tel Aviv Global Center does not open.
You know, these protests are sort of catching fire, so to speak. There are more universities nationwide that are now holding these similar events, and even some overseas, as in Paris. Do you think that these movements are being inspired with what's happening at Columbia, or has this something that's been sort of simmering under the surface over the situation in general in Gaza?
Well, I think the feelings have always been there, but I think Columbia really at least gave a roadmap for how to do this and how to make it a movement across different states and even different countries.
And how are Jewish students in general feeling? We've been hearing across the country, anti-Semitic incidents have risen dramatically. That includes on campuses. Are Jewish students there concerned for their safety, or how are they feeling in general?
I would say a vast majority of Jewish students are concerned for their safety and felt even more concerned when all these outside protests are happening outside of Columbia. Because usually, even though the demonstrators on campus, some of their rhetoric is abhorrent, but they are accountable to the university. Demonstrators outside are not. So it's unclear what they will do and if they will take actions that will fundamentally destabilize the Columbia community.
Are they afraid of potential violence? Are they feeling like this is an anti-Jewish sentiment, or are people equating the complaints about the Israeli government's operations in general?
I personally don't like characterizing the whole protest as anti-Semitic. I feel like it's dangerous to cast everyone as anti-Semitic and really play into this dehumanizing narrative of it being us versus them. Like, there has been exponentially more harassment directed towards Jewish students as well as pro-Palestinian students and Muslim students since this encampment started, and even going back since October 7th. I would like to add just that to my point earlier about the dehumanization, this rhetoric has also been directed at pro-Palestinian students. For example, many of my friends who I went to school with for 4 years, I lived with one of them my sophomore year, and they got their keffiyehs ripped off at our school gala and called terrorists or sluts and whores, which is completely unacceptable. And I think goes to show how this dangerous binary of our side versus their side just perpetuates more hatred in an environment where we can't talk to each other.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Of course.
Henry Sears is a co-president of the student organization J Street at Columbia University. The complex and emotionally charged issues related to the war in Gaza have left leadership at these academic institutions struggling to find a delicate balance when it comes to supporting free speech while ensuring students feel safe. Ben Wisner, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, is with us now to discuss how it has all played out.
The universities are in a bit of a conundrum to uphold obligations to free speech, a beacon of what campus campuses, particularly Columbia University, have been known for, but also protecting students.
Well, I think that's exactly right, that universities have two obligations here. The first is to be forums where people can express political views, even controversial views, even views that may be deeply offensive to other members of the community. The other is to protect members of the community from discriminatory harassment and conduct that makes it difficult or impossible for them to be students at that university. And this can be a tightrope that universities have to walk. And I think that so far, most of the universities have not been walking it very well. And they're responding to political pressure from members of Congress and other elected officials who are urging them to take steps to shut down what should be protected offensive speech and not only to step in to protect students from actual threats or intimidation or harassment.
House Speaker Mike Johnson was just on the campus speaking to a group of Jewish students this week, calling for this to end, calling this not free speech, that it was anti-Semitism. Are officials conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism? But at the same time, some Jewish students say they don't feel safe.
Right. Well, I mean, let me also just say that from the standpoint of the First Amendment, we have to distinguish between private universities like Columbia that actually can have whatever speech rules they want, and public universities like, say, the University of Texas, where we've seen protests that are bound by the Constitution. But Columbia has stated that it wants to create a free speech environment that has similar protections to the First Amendment. There's a difference between students feeling offended and uncomfortable and students being actually harassed. And there are comments that should be protected if they're made in the context of a public protest that would be unprotected if they were shouted as a slur at a particular student or pinned to their dorm room door. And so really the hard call the universities have to make is, when do these public protests cross a line to the point that individual students are being personally targeted, intimidated, or harassed? In the absence of that, our view has always been that part of what schools are trying to teach is the difficulty of living in a pluralistic society. And part of that involves confronting ideas, opinions that are deeply offensive. Now, from a legal standpoint, it doesn't matter if the criticism is anti-Semitic or not. It both enjoys constitutional protection. Of course, from the standpoint of Columbia University, they seem to be in the process of revising their free speech commitments and to leaning more towards prohibiting the expression of offensive views. The other thing is that universities, like any other entities, can have reasonable rules for when and where protests can take place. Most campuses don't allow students to create encampments and to stay in one place for days or weeks or even months. And as long as those rules are neutral, not based on the views being expressed, and are enforced in a fair way, there's no free speech objection to a school prohibiting encampments. I think, though, that what you're seeing is schools that perhaps maybe allowed these kinds of encampments in the past are now cracking down on them, in part because of the viewpoints expressed. And I think that calling in the police, as some of these universities have been doing, should really be a last resort, because it's likely to escalate rather than calm down the tensions on campus.
Right. We've seen dozens of protesters arrested at campuses, students facing charges of trespassing or even suspension.
Right. And to be fair, some of those students in the great tradition of civil disobedience may choose to be arrested as a way of showing their moral commitment, as a way of calling more attention to their cause. It certainly has had that effect. You know, I myself, when I was a college student, got arrested in anti-war protests, and I wasn't trying to avoid arrest. I was trying to call more attention to what we were doing. And so I think that's not a violation of free speech, as long as those rules, again, are being fairly applied. You know, nonetheless, I think university presidents should be very cautious about calling in armed police into volatile situations on their campus where emotions are high, because of the risk of tragic violence.
So where's the balance? How do these institutions find a balance to where there is a safe space to protest and free speech and demonstration while not causing fear in other students?
This isn't a new problem, and this is something that universities, particularly public universities, have had to grapple with for quite a long time. And I would say they need to be very steadfast that they are not imposing any discipline because of a disfavored viewpoint. That if they are going to apply their rules about time, place, or manner for protest, that they do that in a fair and neutral way. And that, yes, they do have an obligation to make sure that violence has no place in these protests, and targeted harassment of students will be prevented and will be punished where it happens. It's not an easy job. No one thinks it's an easy job. They're not going to get it right every time. But the important thing is to hold up those values and try to stick to them as much as possible.
What about calls for removal of university presidents and leadership?
I've been most disappointed by the rhetoric coming from political leaders. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. The reason why free speech needs constitutional protection is that the framers of the Constitution did not trust political leaders, because we only need protection for speech that is not popular. Nonetheless, I hope political leaders will not try to light a fire under this situation for partisan gain, but will help to de-escalate the situation. We'll understand that these kinds of differences on campus are ways of preparing our college students to be future citizens and future leaders of this country.
Is the size and scope and magnitude of this particular ongoing situation unprecedented? Where does it stand historically?
I was not around during the Vietnam era protests that roiled campuses. I will say that I think that social media, 24-hour cable news, ways that footage and information can pass instantly across the country and across the world can create a kind of tinderbox where things can start small and can get large very, very quickly. And, you know, certainly this is one of the most passionate and sustained protest movements on college campuses that I've witnessed. And I hope that these protests remain peaceful. That's where they get their moral force.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Ben Wisner, attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. And as to the ongoing conflict itself in Gaza, Egypt sent a high-level delegation to Israel on Friday with the hope of brokering a ceasefire agreement with Hamas. We have details from John Gambrell with the Associated Press.
This has been described as sort of a last-ditch effort ahead of a possible Israeli ground offensive in Rafah. That's that city in the southern Gaza Strip where half of Gaza's 2.3 million people now live. The Israelis, in footage that the Associated Press has gathered, have already put armored personnel carriers, tanks, and other equipment in southern Israel, potentially preparing for that ground offensive. We've also seen tents starting to be built north of Rafah, suggesting that there might be this ground offensive. Now, it hasn't started yet, and the Israelis still want to try to get some of those over 100 hostages believed to still be held in the Gaza Strip back to Israel. Those negotiations are ongoing, and it remains unclear whether or not there'll be a breakthrough. But as of right now, the threat of that Rafah offensive remains real, and this does seem to be an effort to try to halt it.
That was John Gambrell with the Associated Press. The humanitarian crisis in Gaza continues to be dire. UN World Food Program Deputy Executive Director Carl Scow said Thursday, while there's been an uptick in aid getting into Gaza, it's a drop in the bucket of what is needed.
We're still heading towards a famine. We haven't seen that paradigm shift that is needed to avert a famine. We need more volume, more predictability, and a sustained effort to get more diverse assistance into the north.
Egypt and Western allies have warned that an Israeli offensive in Rafah could have catastrophic consequences for civilians and regional stability. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Well, this week marked the 54th annual Earth Day celebration. This year's theme was Plastic versus Planet. And coinciding with the occasion, thousands of negotiators and observers representing most of the world's nations were gathering in Canada to craft the first ever legally binding global treaty to end the rapidly escalating problem of plastic pollution, a critical element of the climate crisis.
Plastic now, it's everywhere. It's in our fresh water. It's in rivers and lakes. I'm coming from Switzerland. We find microplastic and in every lake in the mountains and in the soil, in the air.
Experts say the oceans are ground zero for plastic pollution. We're joined by Dr. Anya Brandon, Associate Director of U.S. Plastics Policy with the Ocean Conservancy, who's been attending the meetings.
What's the status of the negotiations? And tell us a little bit about some of the central elements that are trying to be achieved with this treaty.
So we are actually in the fourth round of negotiations out of a scheduled 5 total. So in theory, we're over halfway. And this round of negotiations is really the first time that we're seeing countries start to dig in and actually negotiate, which is pretty exciting. In terms of issues on the table, I mean, there's everything to cover still left on the table, from microplastics to what we're going to do to reduce the amount of plastics we make and use in the first place. So we are really just getting started here. This is an international treaty that's been kicked off through the UN Environment Program. So we have representatives from all the countries around the world here working together to tackle plastic pollution, because we know plastic pollution, like so many other environmental crises, don't follow geographic boundaries. So we all need to work together to really solve this issue.
And some of the issues that are of concern, my understanding, is something called ghost gear. What does that term mean and what is it?
Ghost gear is another name for abandoned, lost, or otherwise discarded fishing gear. And the vast majority of this gear are actually made out of plastics. So if it becomes lost or abandoned somehow out at sea, it can have devastating impact on marine life. Pound for pound, ghost gear that's out in the ocean is the most harmful type of plastic marine debris. And really far-ranging implications, lost and otherwise discarded fishing gear, ranging from ecosystem impacts and devastating impacts to marine life, from whales and other marine mammals getting caught, but also economic impacts. There's been really strong evidence that shows that ghost gear can drive down impact existing fisheries. So both, you know, the economics of losing potential gear, but also other fishers out there getting their nets caught in ghost gear and things like that. It really has a large economic impact to the industry as well as safety. You know, if a boat gets caught in this abandoned gear itself, that can also have real human costs.
Humans are also not immune from the problem. You mentioned microplastics, and we've been hearing a lot in recent years about microplastics literally being found in human beings, in even newborns. Also a big part of the treaty.
Microplastics are a huge threat. Well, we know that we see all the visible impacts from plastic bags and straws and water bottles out on our beach. That visible pollution is really just the tip of the iceberg, hiding far more devastating invisible impacts from things like microplastics, as well as toxic chemicals in the plastic, as well as greenhouse gas emissions from the entire life cycle of plastics, since we know that plastics are, after all, made out of fossil fuels. When it comes to microplastics, you're absolutely right. Scientists have found microplastics just about everywhere they've looked in the human body. And we know we are consuming microplastics through the food we eat, the water we drink, and the air we breathe. In fact, a colleague of mine at Ocean Conservancy published a paper recently, a study that found that on average, Americans may be consuming 3.8 million microplastics a year from proteins that we eat alone.
Would you say it's from seafood, or is it more broad than that?
It's far broader than just seafood, and that's specifically what they were trying to study. They tested everything from red meat to seafood to plant-based proteins, and they found microplastics in every single type of protein they tested. So this is much bigger than just food. And in terms of, you know, how this issue is showing up in this international global plastics treaty, we've seen some really good language about reducing intentionally added microplastics. So those microplastics that are designed to be small in the first place, from microbeads in our face wash to things like glitter. But we know that the vast majority of microplastics out in the environment are from secondary microplastics. So those microplastics that degrade off of larger plastic items. And we'd love to see more action in the treaty to address those types of microplastics. A legally binding obligation by all countries to take actions to end plastic pollution. And what that looks like is still being negotiated. We really need to get away from the idea of single use, eliminate unnecessary packaging and plastic, as well as better manage the plastics that we do end up needing through, and being able to actually require them to be recyclable in the first place.
Right. There's just plastic in places we don't even realize that we're, you know, just something you purchase and then you open the box and it's wrapped in more plastic.
Absolutely. It is truly monumental. Single-use plastics are what we are pushing to address first, because single-use plastics represent about 40% of all plastics that we're making every single year. 40% of all the plastics we're making are designed to just be used once before being thrown away.
When does the final negotiation process process expected to be complete?
As currently scheduled, we should have a fifth round of negotiations at the end of November in Busan, South Korea, followed by another meeting early next year just to sign the international legally binding instrument or treaty into effect. That is an incredibly rapid timeline that I think speaks to the urgency of this crisis. And we hope that countries are willing to roll up their sleeves and get to work to make sure we can keep it to that timeline.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this important issue with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Anya Brandon, Associate Director of U.S. Plastics Policy with the Ocean Conservancy. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you very much for listening. For more news throughout the week, visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.